The matter of State versus ALA. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Yes. Allison Gifford, Assistant Deputy Public Defender for ALA.
Good morning, Your Honors. Monica Trigero, Special Deputy Attorney General, Acting Assistant Monmouth County Prosecutor.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Please be advised, Justice Solomon is participating in today's argument. He's going to be watching the recording of today's event and will be fully participating, and that applies to all matters today. Ms. Gifford, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
And you're welcome to take off your mask during your argument if you like.
Thank you. Our legislature has contemplated the use of corporal punishment by a guardian and has been careful to penalize only the use of excessive corporal punishment. The purpose of this limitation is to protect parents' constitutional rights to raise their children and to prevent the unnecessary separation of families. Because this essential legal principle was not properly articulated to the jury in ALA's case, reversal of her simple assault conviction is required. ALA was tried for allegedly endangering 4 grandchildren under her care. The charges were based on accusations of corporal punishment. ALA's defense was that although she would occasionally use force to discipline her grandchildren, her behavior never crossed the line into illegal conduct. At the conclusion of trial, one of the endangering charges was dismissed, and the jury was instructed on endangering and the lesser included of simple assault with respect to the remaining 3 grandchildren. While the jury was correctly told to acquit ALA of endangering if it found her use of corporal punishment reasonable, it was not told the same with respect to simple assault, despite defense counsel's request for such a charge. The jury acquitted ALA of all endangering charges, but convicted her of 1 count of simple assault. Looking at the jury's verdict, it is very possible, if not likely, that the jury acquitted ALA of endangering because it found her use of corporal punishment reasonable, but then went on to convict her of simple assault because it was not told that this finding required an acquittal of the simple assault charge as well. In other words, there is a serious likelihood that had the jury been properly instructed on the law, ALA would have been acquitted of all charges. Accordingly, ALA respectfully requests that this court reverse her simple assault conviction and order a new trial. And that concludes my preliminary statement. As detailed in my supplemental brief, the principle that parents can lawfully inflict reasonable corporal punishment dates back to the common law and has been incorporated into the laws of every state in this country. In New Jersey, we see this principle reflected in 2 places. In the endangering and Title IX statutes, which only penalize excessive corporal punishment, and in NJSA 2C38, which makes reasonable corporal punishment an affirmative defense when a guardian is charged under a statute that doesn't explicitly address corporal punishment.
Hey, counsel, is it your position that the court should have given the same language from KA that it gave in the endangering charge on the simple assault charge, just repeated it afterwards?
In this case, that would have been appropriate, I think, to capture the principle of 2C38, but I think ideally on a retrial here, there would be a model charge on the 2C38 defense, which just explicitly lays out, I agree with the state's 4 elements of the 2C38 defense, which together captures the principle that reasonable corporal punishment is not a crime, but 2C38 breaks it down into 4 categories, and I can kind of go through those 4 and highlight why, in this case, there was more than enough evidence of each of these elements for that charge.
But in this case, the defense attorney was asking for the KA language, correct?
Yes, and the KA language actually is taken from the State versus Richardson case from a very long time ago, which is articulating the common law defense that reasonable corporal punishment is not a crime. And then we see in 2C38 that the commentary cites to Richardson as a principle of reasonable corporal punishment that the charge is meant to reflect. So all of these are really the same, substantively the same thing, and articulate the legal principle that reasonable corporal punishment is not a crime.
And it's your position that when defense counsel requested the KA language, that was the substantial equivalent of referencing 2C38.
Yes, Your Honor. And at that point, the trial court had an obligation to accurately instruct the jury on the law.
you want to address the four elements, you're welcome to do so. Just try to do so succinctly.
Yes, I will, Your Honor. Thank you. So the first element is that the defendant is vested with a special responsibility for the care, supervision, discipline, or safety of another. And here there's no dispute that ALA falls under that category as the guardian of her four grandchildren. The second element is that the force was used for the purpose of furthering that responsibility, so that, in essence, the force had a disciplinary purpose. Again, there was no question that was supported by the record. The testimony about corporal punishment came from the teenagers in this case who testified that ALA had very strict rules and that occasionally force was used when these rules were broken. The third element is that the force was used to the extent necessary to further that responsibility, which in essence captures the principle that the force itself not be excessive. And the evidence in this case of any injury was utterly lacking. There was no medical records. Both the caseworker and detective testified that they didn't see any injuries. The teenagers told the caseworker that the older girls were always spanked with their clothes on. The lack of evidence in this case of injury was enough to suggest that for a jury to find that the force wasn't excessive. The final element is that the defendant's belief in the need to use force was reasonable. And this was the theory that was repeatedly reiterated by defense counsel. There was testimony here about ALA's strict rules and the tragic fate of her own children. And defense counsel emphasized both in opening and summation that ALA had such strict rules and would occasionally use corporal punishment because she didn't want her grandchildren to suffer the same fate as her own children. Again, there was enough evidence here to submit that element, to submit the charge to the jury. So in sum, there was just more than a rational basis here to support ALA's reasonable corporal punishment defense. And the court was therefore required to instruct the jury that reasonable corporal punishment is a defense to simple assault.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
The judge repeatedly apprised the jury that corporal punishment is a lawful and accepted means of disciplining children. He said that not just in the charge for the second degree offense, but throughout the jury charge, he made that clear that the physical discipline was a lawful practice.
No, Your Honor, that was just stated in the second degree.
Didn't he say it at the end as he was recapping for the jury?
No, he did not.
The charge?
In this case, the defense counsel asked at the end of the charge that it be added to simple assault, and the trial court rejected that suggestion. So it was never articulated to the jury in any other context except the endangering instruction.
Was it the defendant's position that she did not strike the 3-year-old as claimed 12 times with a belt? What was the position of the defense on that?
ALA's position was that conceded that there was some spanking that happened in the recording, but that it was unclear exactly what was. It was an audio recording, not a video. And so it was unclear exactly what was happening in that recording, and that it was ultimately up to the jury to decide what was happening in that recording and did it cross a line. So ALA conceded throughout the case that she would occasionally use corporal punishment and that there was some spanking that was happening in this video, but exactly how severe that was a question for the jury to decide, and whether it crossed the line into illegal conduct was for the jury to decide.
So we may be getting ahead in your argument. This hints toward the harmless error question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why don't you address that?
Yes, so since
you have, if I understood it correctly, 12 times a 3-year-old was struck with a belt for playing games and not going to bed early enough. Explain your position on harmless error.
Well, I think there's two things that I would like to address there. The first is that, as I just reiterated, the recording, it's unclear exactly what was happening in the recording. And as defense counsel emphasized in summation, we don't know if the belt is hitting the child or the bed. We don't know if the child is screaming out of fear or out of pain. Ultimately, whether that was excessive was a question for the jury. And we had testimony here from the older girls that the girls would be sent to their bed if there was rules broken, that was like a timeout, and that here the girl got out of bed after being told to get into bed. Again, this not for this court to decide, you know, whether or not this was excessive or reasonable, but just whether there was enough evidence for the jury to have to make that decision in this case. And here what's critical is that the jury acquitted ALA of all endangering charges. So there is a strong suggestion in the jury's verdict that it did not find her use of corporal punishment excessive, and that's why it acquitted of endangering with respect to AA and the remaining of the rest of the grandchildren. And I think that
what was the timing between the claim striking the child with a belt and the time when the children were checked at the hospital to see whether they had any injuries? And apparently, according to the record, they had none. Go ahead.
Yeah, my understanding was about 2 weeks between when, 1 to 2 weeks between when the spanking occurred and when the children were checked for no injuries. And again, the older girls were testifying in this case that this supposedly happened every other day. And the defense in this case was that the older girls were not credible in their testimony and that they were exaggerating the frequency and excessiveness of the corporal punishment because they didn't want to, they didn't like the strict rules of ALA and they wanted to get out from under her care. And so the defense in this case really was that that testimony wasn't credible, which the jury seemed to believe because it acquitted her of so many of the charges. But
we really don't speculate as to the reason for an acquittal, just as we don't speculate as to the reason for a conviction of one offense and not the other, do we?
We don't know exactly what happened in the jury room.
I mean, but I see your argument is that with the KA charge, that she was acquitted of endangering, so perhaps that charge created enough reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury as to whether she was guilty on endangering. But we just have no way, and it is as it should be, to know what goes on in a jury room.
You're right, Your Honor. We don't know what happened in the jury room, but when we're trying to figure out the question of whether the omission of this charge could have impacted the jury's verdict, there's certainly a possibility that the jury didn't find that the corporal punishment was excessive, and that had the jury been properly instructed on the law with respect to simple assault, that it would have acquitted on that charge as well.
How were the children dressed in this incident?
The children were always fully clothed. The older girls testified, the only testimony came from the older girls, but testified that the younger girls were always fully clothed during any spanking. And again, there was no evidence of any injury when they were checked at any point throughout this case. And as defense counsel highlighted, throughout their entire childhood, there was never any report from school teachers or from friends or anyone who came into contact with the girls that there was injuries that were observed.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. In addressing the harmless error question, I really think that I'd just like to highlight how Judge Fisher, I think, put it perfectly in his dissent when he said that. And again, I know we don't speculate on the jury's, on exactly what the jury's verdict was, but Judge Fisher said, it takes no great leap of faith to assume that the jury acquitted defendant of child endangerment because it believed she was disciplining the child, but not excessively. Indeed, that was the defendant's theory. Thus, it is highly likely that after acquitting defendant of endangering this one child, it convicted her of simple assault for engaging in that exact same conduct because it was not told it could acquit if it believed defendant was merely spanking the child in a reasonable way.
So are you saying we should get engaged in that kind of inquiry to try to figure out what could have happened? Obviously, endangering has several elements. We have no idea why the jury decided to acquit, just as we have no idea why they decided to convict of simple assault. Shouldn't we just steer clear of speculating on the results of a verdict as to why?
We, in terms of dealing with the harmless error question, we do know that one of the elements of endangering is that the corporal punishment be excessive, and that defendant was acquitted of that charge. And as I highlighted earlier, the real question is whether the lack of as you're right, Your Honor. The real question is whether the omission of this instruction with respect to simple assault could have impacted the jury's deliberations.
There's
here.
There's also the element of debauching the morals, of the language of...
There are additional elements of endangering.
They could have felt the state's proof fell short on that.
Yes, Your Honor, but certainly the acquittal of the endangering doesn't, I think, undermine ALA's argument that there's a real risk that the jury here, had it been properly instructed, could have acquitted her of the simple assault charge as well.
I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
You would agree that the evidence would support that striking a three-year-old girl with a belt 12 times, as the child cried every time, a reasonable jury could find that to be excessive corporal punishment.
A reasonable jury could find excessive, or given the totality of the circumstances in this case and all of the circumstances that ALA was dealing with at the time and her reason for having such strict rules, and perhaps that the, what was happening, if the jury wanted to find that what was happening in the recording was not, as defense counsel suggested in summation, that the belt was, or whatever was happening in that jury was not, in that recording was not necessarily the child herself being spanked or screaming out of pain. It could have been fear. These were questions that were ultimately for the jury to decide whether it was excessive or not. And the jury could have decided either way. But at the end of the day, the jury needed to be given the instruction that if it did find that it was reasonable, then that required an acquittal of the simple assault charge.
But the state's theory was never that corporal punishment is illegal, is excessive corporal punishment, the question the jury needed to determine.
Yeah, the state didn't dispute that on at trial, but said that it was reasonably entrenched in the other part of the instruction. But it was only given with respect to the endangering charge. It was never repeated in the simple assault charge. So it seemed at trial that the state didn't agree with the substance of the request, but thought it was elsewhere. But I think the jury instruction makes clear that it was not.
Ms. Gifford, is simple assault commonly charged as a lesser included for endangering?
I don't have the data behind how often that happens. I think it could. I wouldn't be surprised if it happened. If there was assault was charged either as a lesser or related offense in these child endangerment cases. And I think that you're really essential in those types of cases that the jury is being told that if we're dealing with cases of corporal punishment and assault is being used to criminalize that conduct, then the jury has to acquit if it finds that the corporal punishment is reasonable, because that's what 2C38 represents, and that there's important reasons behind that limitation, which I highlighted in my opening statement, that we don't want to, we want to protect parents' constitutional rights to raise their children. We don't want to unnecessarily separate families, and we know there are serious collateral consequences, both from a criminal conviction and a finding of abuse and neglect in Title IX proceedings.
Just to be clear, because this was something that arose in my mind as well, simple assault is not a lesser included offense of endangering.
I believe it's a related offense, Your Honor.
It is a related offense.
Yes.
I only point that out because it's repeated in the record as though it is a lesser included, but you concede that it is.
I concede that it's a related, but here, because defense counsel agreed to the charge and there was a rational basis in the record for the charge, it was appropriate to charge the jury on that lesser count. But I agree, Your Honor, that it's a related, not an included offense.
Anything you'd like to add?
If Your Honors have no further questions, I'd just like to sum up by saying that the omission of 2C38 from ALA's case created a serious risk that she was convicted of a crime and separated from her grandchildren, despite breaking no law. And if this court finds no error with ALA's trial, then parents across the state are at risk of being incarcerated and torn from their families for using any force against their children, even if a jury would have found that force reasonable. That's the exact outcome that 2C38 aims to prevent. ALA deserves a fair trial where the jury is properly instructed on the law.
Thank you. Mr. Otero.
This case asks this court to address an issue of first impression, the affirmative defense contained in 2C3-8, a statute that's been untouched by our legislature since it was enacted with the 2C, and for which there's been no case precedent interpreting it. But within the well-settled framework of the standards of review governing jury instructions, the state submits that the determination of the ultimate issue before this court, whether this defendant is entitled to a new trial, rises and falls with this standard of review. The state submits this is not a case where the defendant requested the 2C3-8 instruction in the first instance before the trial court. I think would state that the record here is clear that 2C3-8 does not enter this case until a footnote in the dissenting opinion, the opinion that brings this case before this court. As set forth and defined by the appellate division majority decision with extensive quotes from the defendant's submissions of the issue before it. It saw the issue before it to be one of a request by the defendant of the trial court to tailor the simple assault instruction to the material facts of the case before it by telling the jury essentially that not all corporal punishment or corporal punishment is not simple assault. This request by trial counsel did not cite 22C3-8 by statutory citation, nor did it cite to it by reference to all of the elements. And the state would submit that those failures make this not a clear request for the 2C3-8 defense. In an interesting position of being before this court, counsel for the state agrees with counsel to the defendant with regard to the four elements of the 3-8 defense. And in order for the trial court to have to have been required to give this instruction, where not requested, the state would submit, under this court's precedent of State versus Walker, there would need to have been some evidence as to each of these elements, the special responsibility, the purpose, the necessity, and reasonableness. And the state would submit that here, the necessity and purpose elements, there was not sufficient evidence with regard to those in order to require the court to give this unrequested instruction. While the testimony with regard to this instance of abuse of the 3-year-old Ariana was sparse, what we have is the testimony of 17-year-old Kiara that stated that immediately prior to the 12 strikes with the belt, Ariana got out of bed to get a toy. And this is the sole evidence that we have in this record with regard to why the 3-year-old was struck 12 times with a belt, admittedly over her clothing, but while she was crying and saying, ow. Because these facts do not clearly indicate all of the elements of the 2C3-8 defense, the trial court did not err in not providing that instruction to the jury, and the defendant's conviction should be affirmed. I'm happy to answer any of the questions that the court might have.
If the charge in this case, or a case similar to this one, against a grandmother or a custodian, was only simple assault, would it be legally appropriate for a judge simply to charge on injury and intent, and no more than those two elements?
Well, I mean, if the only charge was simple assault, there would be no need for a jury instruction at all because it would be in municipal court and it would be a bench trial. So there would be no instruction. The judge would just be considering the charge.
Would it be sufficient?
Despite
the hypothetical, would it be sufficient for the municipal court judge to come back and say, I find these two elements and my analysis need go no further?
No, I mean, I think that 2C3-8 sets forth those four elements. And I think they address what we all kind of somehow inherently know when it comes to, I think, the physical abuse of a child, right? That what is going to be, and I think this case sort of highlights it as well, what's going to be reasonable and necessary to a specific parenting purpose is going to be different depending on the age of the child and why the corporal punishment or why the assaultive conduct is occurring. And so I think a court would have to address all four elements in order to find the affirmative defense
so in this
applicable.
Case, you've correctly pointed out that counsel didn't cite to the statute ahead of time. There was an objection immediately after the conclusion of the charge where counsel came forward and said, Judge, tell the jury that spanking is not simple assault if it arises during reasonable corporal punishment of a child. Wouldn't it have been appropriate under the law for the judge to have given that charge faced with that objection?
I think faced with that objection, and again, what was being requested was tailoring the simple assault instruction to include the TC and the KA language that the appellate division majority opinion recognized only applies to the endangering charges. I don't think that this tailoring or this, I mean, essentially directed verdict encompasses all that the jury would need to decide in order to find.
Why not? Why not? I mean, the law says that a parent or a custodian is permitted to exercise reasonable corporal punishment, not excessive, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, like, why wouldn't that be reasonable? And why wasn't that the substantial equivalent of 2C3:8?
Well, because I think you're missing that necessity and purpose. And I understand this. The idea, I think, is that what reasonable corporal punishment is broad enough of a term to encompass that, but 3-8 isn't a corporal punishment statute. It's not the KA.
And why wasn't it enough for a judge trained in the law to know when requesting the that KA language would necessarily bring to mind 238? And I'm saying that because it's obvious that we're dealing with a legal custodian of a child. And I think you conceded in your answer to the Chief Justice's question, if this was just a simple assault case and you were dealing with a parent who smacked a child, you wouldn't be looking to just the simple elements of assault, okay? Because a purposely striking a child causing pain, which is an ouch, that's enough to convict someone of an assault.
I mean, I think the idea that it would have been enough, I mean, I think this case shows it's not, right? Because we have trial counsel that doesn't ask for the 3-8 by citation again to the statute, the elements, or anything. We have a defense counsel that doesn't raise it before the trial, before the appellate court.
He said it's not a crime. This is what the defense counsel is saying. It is not a crime for a grandmother to exercise corporal punishment on a child. Would you agree with that? Reasonable.
I think with regard to a 24-4 abuse and neglect, that
I'm talking about simple assault.
I know, Your Honor, and that's what I was going to say. With regard to a simple assault, where the only defense to it, the defense to it is what is recognized in 3-8, the elements of 3-8, all elements, there would need to be some evidence for the judge to find it, right? If it's clearly indicated, you're saying that this is enough, that this, where the defense counsel is framing it in terms of tailoring simple assault to match 2C24-4 and arguing that what I am asking for is to import that definition.
Yes, because it was enough. Because if it's enough for second degree endangering, if it is enough as a defense to a second degree endangering, how could it not be a defense to a disorderly person's simple assault? If a grandmother is not guilty of second degree endangering because she reasonably exercised corporal punishment, assuming that, how could she possibly be convicted of a simple assault?
Using
that same standard. Go ahead.
Because it's not a defense to 24-4. It's a failure of the state to prove an element, the element being that the child was abused and neglected. And within that definition that of abuse and neglect that we, by the legislature's direction, import from Title IX, it's that excessive corporal punishment does not make a child abused and neglected. And again, I also don't want to get into looking behind a jury's verdict, but there's a big difference between a jury finding that one instance of abuse does not make that child an abused and neglected child as defined by Title IX and 24-4 versus the jury looking at one specific instance and deciding if that was assaultive conduct.
You're saying that there's really no basis to conclude that the reason for the jury verdict of acquittal in the case of endangering was the KA language.
I mean, there's enough here. I mean, we also have a defense that, again, doesn't really address, and this is how this was enough for the judge. The defense presented doesn't address all four elements of 3-8 because the defense wasn't asking for 3-8. It was asking for importation from Title IX through 24-4 because what the evidence is Kiara's a liar, right? I mean, the testimony about this is Kiara's a liar. There's two witnesses called by the defense that say Kiara is a liar, and the focus is on the teenagers. Even the evidence with regard to reasonableness that's presented by defense counsel relates to the teenagers and shows why it's not enough just to say it's exercising reasonable corporal punishment, because the testimony is it's to prevent them from drugs and gangs, but this is a three-year-old. It's to make them do their homework and do their chores. This is a three-year-old that there's no testimony that she has homework or chores to do.
Let's parse the argument you're advancing right now. You don't dispute, of course, that if defense counsel had said, I want a 238 charge, notwithstanding the defense that they presented in this case, they would have been entitled to it, correct?
It would have been a different, it would have been a different question for the trial court, and it would have been a different question for the appellate court with regard to whether that request was reasonable. And I think—
So are you saying that the judge would not have had to provide a 238 charge if requested under the facts of this case?
I guess my answer, Your Honor, and I'm not trying to be obtuse and not answer your question. This is why I think this case is a standard of review case, because I think what I'm pushing back on is the idea that asking for something very specific is enough to get something else. Because the standard of review is to force the difference between a requested charge and a not requested charge is to force counsel to make the appropriate requests before the trial court so that the instructions can be given.
All true, and I'm not gonna stop you from presenting the fulsome nature of your argument. My question is, had counsel asked for this at trial, would the judge have been charged to provide a 238 charge under the evidence in this case?
I think a cautious judge would have provided the instruction.
All right, so let's deal with a cautious judge reviewing the very four elements that you nicely laid out in your brief. The fourth element, that the defendant believed the force was reasonable, force was necessary to further this responsibility was reasonable, is essentially what counsel asked for, no?
Yes, counsel asked for the reasonableness. I'm not going to dispute that counsel's argument.
So why shouldn't a cautious judge have provided that very charge?
Because that instruction and the way it was asked and framed does not represent all of the elements of 3-8. The way that request was made, that reasonableness being the touchstone, sure, it doesn't meet all four elements of 3-8.
But the heart of this charge, and tell me if you have a different view, appears to be the fourth element. There's not much dispute that the defendant grandmother was entrusted with a special responsibility for the children, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's not much dispute that a use of force was for that purpose and exercising that responsibility as the guardian, is there?
I don't know that I would interpret purpose that broadly. I mean, I think that's what defense counsel's argument is, right? That the purpose is just a generic parental purpose in every case. I think to me, I look at it more narrowly. I think it's the purpose with regard to this simple assault. I mean, I think that's why this instruction or this defense is different than what defendant is asking for, what gets imported through 24-4. I don't know that it's a general parental purpose. I think it's what was the purpose in this, with regard to this assault. And with regard to this assault, the evidence we have is that the child got out of bed and wanted a toy.
But again, the third element, I take it, has minimal weight in this analysis.
The necessity?
Not deadly force. Necessary to further the responsibility and not deadly force.
Well, I think the not deadly force part comes from subsection C, which says that deadly force is excluded. But I think necessity is, it's like the touchstone of this defense. I mean, reasonableness, yes, but necessity, I think, is just as important.
So your view is that if this charge had to be given, it could only be given in its entirety, not what defense counsel had requested for under the facts here.
Yes, I mean, I think if the defense was just reasonableness, that's what 3-8 would say, but it doesn't. It talks about necessity to purpose,
and
here—
What does necessity mean? You have to remember, there's a constitutional construct over a parent's right to raise a child. So the question in terms of discipline of a child, are you saying that under our constitution, that a parent can only exercise discipline from necessity? Is that what you're saying?
I think that the force used, the way that I read 3-8 is that the force used, the amount of force used, has to be necessary to effectuate that parental purpose. And it can't be more.
Every parent will want to know whether or not they are violating our simple assault statute if they are using corporal punishment that doesn't meet a standard of necessity. And your answer to all those parents is?
Yes, okay. Yes. And I think this case, you can easily see where the lines are. And I think specifically with this case, the question that the court has to ask is, was it enough for the jury to have to make the decision or not, right? That's the clearly indicated standard. But yes, I mean, what you have is a child, a 3-year-old, a toddler, that struck 12 times with a belt.
Forget about a three-year-old. Let's take.
But that is the facts of this case.
I understand, but I'm trying to understand your use of the term necessity. A parent slaps a 15-year-old child, and let's say it wasn't necessary, and certainly isn't governed by necessity. The parent did it because the child didn't perform some function around the house. Is a parent guilty of simple assault?
I think, again, I think you need all of the facts surrounding it, and I think that might be a situation where it presents a jury question, like a question for the jury. I mean, under these facts.
So you're saying that's chargeable, that a parent should know that he or she can be brought to municipal court for that.
I mean, I think, and I apologize, I forget who asked, but the question was asked of my adversary, is whether simple assault is often charged or whether it's often. I mean, this is not. This is not a fact pattern.
Remember,
that happens assault. Often.
Remember, all you need for an assault is pain. That could be a mild slap and ouch. And that's it. You have an assault. So, for instance, if you have a five-year-old in a store and drops a cone, parent slaps the kid on the hand. He says, ouch. That's obviously going to be not excessive corporal punishment. It's not going to be assault. But if a stranger does the same thing, that's an assault, correct?
Yes. Yes. I mean, yes, but I don't know that that addresses the fact pattern here. Because again, like this is all under the framework of whether or not this was so clearly into these facts so clearly indicated.
So that's the next question I want to ask you.
Okay.
During the course of a trial, when an attorney says, Your Honor, that is not an excited utterance. That's not an excited utterance. Has the attorney sufficiently protected the record without citing either the evidence rule or the statute for excited utterance? Is that going to protect the record?
Well, I think what...
Or is he going to have to say, well, that's NJRE... Go ahead.
No, I mean, he's using the title of the rule, but that's not what happened here either. I mean, the title of this statute is use of force by persons with special responsibility for the care and discipline of a child. That's not stated. A statutory citation is not stated. And all of the elements of the defense are not stated. And it's in the framework of defense counsel saying, I'm asking for a tailored charge under KA. I mean, there's not a single thing other than reasonableness that is supposed to have tipped off this judge that what was requested was a 3-8. And again, this is why I go back to the purpose of these different standards is to direct counsel to clearly present their issue to the trial court.
Is there a difference between asking for a charge on an element of the offense, which as I understand it, that's where KA fit in endangering, and asking for a charge on an affirmative defense? Do you see what I'm saying?
I mean,
what I'm suggesting is those are two distinct concepts as to which there are different burdens of proof, and they're charged. The two types of charges are different because they are dealing with, on one hand, the state's burden, and the other hand, the defendant's burden in terms of the defense. Should a trial judge be expected, when there's a request for, as to element two of the elements for this offense, I'd like the following charge, should the trial judge be expected to be thinking about defenses?
Well, I mean, I think I don't know that it makes it, that one request makes the other also requested. I mean, I think that's what
that's my point.
I don't think so. Because I think the reality is that's why the clearly indicated, under the clearly indicated standard, the trial judge is supposed to say, what do these facts tell me? Are these facts clearly indicating elements of a defense? So that would be there, but I don't know.
As a practice in criminal cases, in the pretrial process, does defense counsel have an obligation to name any defenses that they will be asserting?
I think there's, yeah, there's some obligations under our statutes and our court rules.
Obviously, there's notices of alibi and that sort of thing, but I'm not talking about that, but is it, but in the normal practice, pre-trial?
I think there might, well, I think there's specific ones with like insanity and other defenses like that, that there is a requirement of notice.
Okay. But as to this, is there a requirement that that pre-trial the defense counsel articulate to the court that, that he was looking for this defense?
I don't know if there, I mean, there's absolutely no law on this statute. So, I mean, I don't know that there's anything, but I would just say that also didn't happen here. Like, I'm not asking for defense counsel to be held to, like, insane amounts of precision, Your Honor. I'm not asking for, if defense counsel said 3-9 instead of 3-8, that wouldn't have gotten him in the ballpark. But what I'm saying is, when what you ask for is what you asked, is what the attorney asked for here, and that no attorney, no judge saw as 3-8 until there was a footnote in the dissent that says, it may be that this, not even it is, the dissent's footnote is, it may be that the defense to this is 3-8. I think I'm hard pressed to say that what happened below was enough that the trial court, that Judge English was obligated under a higher standard of review on appeal to have provided this instruction. I think that's my argument.
Please go ahead.
I think in looking at the transcript, I think it's we've covered the fact that defense counsel obviously did not mention 3-8. But in looking at the transcript, it's clear what he was requesting in the context of this particular case. And also, even the court and the state said, well, it's already, the jury kind of already understands that from the previous charge. So even the state, even the prosecutor indicated, well, that the belief that the previous charge given for the child endangerment, during the child endangerment charge would apply to the simple assault. So, you know, in talking in terms of clearly indicating this issue was before, it was before the court. It's not as though it was completely obscure. It was nowhere to be found, and no one thought about the fact that, you know, in the context of a child and a parent or a caregiver, that simple assault, there needed to be some explanation to the jury that reasonable discipline doesn't rise to the level of simple assault.
Well, no, I mean, I think what was before, and I don't mean to be like obtuse, but I think this is fact. What was before the trial court, the context was a tailored charge to instruct the jury that KA's language, the Title IX language that applied to define abuse and neglect, should be instructed with regard to 12-1. Again, what was requested was not in any way all elements of 3-8. I mean, what was asked for was reasonableness. If it's not reasonable, then it's not simple assault. But 3-8 tells us it has to be reasonable, and it has to have a purpose, and it has to have a necessity, or the use of force has to be necessary to effectuate that purpose. So again, I'm not trying to be difficult. What was requested did not put Judge English on notice that that was what was being requested, so that the standard of review on appeal is rationally, like a rational basis instead of clearly indicated.
As a general proposition, I just can't think of an example of this. Do the rational basis and clearly indicated standards apply to defenses? The jumping off the page aspect of it is really, you look at the state's evidence, right, and see if the element, the evidence jumps off the page in the clearly indicated standard. A defense is a whole different animal, is it not?
I mean, it is, and you definitely, I mean, there's a body of case law that talks about, you know, a defendant, I mean, the facts can be there. I mean, it's in, I think, Gorthy with regard to, like, diminished capacity and insanity. A defendant can say, yeah, I understand that you, my counsel, and the court think that this defense applies, but I don't want to raise, and in Gorthy it was an insanity defense, I don't want to raise an insanity defense, and therefore the instruction cannot be given.
That is an example I should have thought of, actually, because I wrote Gorthy. in a way, that was sort of the issue there, is whether there was evidence that would have supported the insanity defense that required the court to give it, and the court decided it had to give it because it was there, and obviously we reversed that determination.
I mean, but I think there's other... I'm not... That was the first example that came to my mind because Gorthy was a Monmouth County case, although I didn't argue it.
Coercion and duress.
I was going to say intoxication, I think, would be another one where a judge might have an obligation to instruct, even if it's not requested, because, you know, if the evidence was that defendant had, you know, been drinking that entire day beforehand, I think that might be a situation.
We have a body of law saying that. I want to go back to the example that the Chief Justice gave early on. And there was a charge of just simple assault. And the facts involve a parent striking a child over a question of discipline without requesting the 2C38 charge. Would it be possible for the judge to try the case without importing that when the defense, and let's say it's the person is self-represented, the defense is, I was just disciplining my son when I smacked him. Could the judge proceed just with, you hit the kid, that's it. You hit the kid and he said, ouch, pain, you're guilty. Could the judge proceed without importing necessarily 2C38? Would it not be so clearly indicated, jumping off the page?
Yes, well, I think that
the judge should do.
I think the judge, as the trier of fact in law, would say, wow, these facts clearly indicate a 3-8 defense, and so I'm going to find it.
Well, what's the difference if he is the trier of fact and trier of law, or if he's handling the law and supposed to properly instruct the jury on the law?
Well, I think the difference is that
whoever the trier of fact is should know what the law is, whether it's a municipal court judge or a jury. Do you agree?
Well, but I think that's what the clearly indicated standard is, right? I mean, if Judge English found, if there were facts that would allow Judge English to have found that 3-8 was clearly indicated, then he would have an obligation to give it. What our argument is these facts don't clearly indicate it because there's not any evidence that the three, or that there was a parental necessity to hit the 3-year-old 12 times because she got out of bed.
Those facts disputed. They were saying that we don't know whether or not the child was struck 12 times, whether or not the belt was hitting the bed and the kid was saying, ouch. Those are all facts that have to be decided by the jury. We don't know what those
but those what the true but facts those are. Facts, if those facts, I mean, because that was the other defense that was argued, right? That Kiara is a liar and so therefore you shouldn't believe her at all. But that is not a 3-8 defense. That's that you didn't establish that the child was struck, right? That's a you didn't establish the elements of simple assault. If the belt was hitting the bed, not the child.
They have been struck. We don't, but not struck in the same fashion as the older child was testifying. That was all for the jury to decide. We don't know precisely what facts they found because they found 3 not guilty simple assaults and they found all the endangering not guilty. I mean, so there are obviously probably some credibility issues there, no?
I mean, but I think that gets back to Justice Patterson's point of we don't know because we don't look behind jury verdicts. I don't know that the example of the municipal court judge versus the trial court judge is helpful because, again, it's whether if the facts were clearly indicated, Judge English would have a requirement to give them. What defense counsel is arguing is that, and I think what some of the questions Your Honor has been asking is whether or not what happened here, what was requested here, was a request that should have, was a request for a 3-8, making it the standard that this court has to apply, the standard that the court below has to apply. Was it a reasonable, was it reasonably requested versus clearly indicated? And that's the state's position, that this case rises and falls there because it was not requested and the only facts that we have do not clearly indicate a necessity in this case. Because if you don't believe Kiara, then we have no facts about why this 3-year-old was hit with a belt, right? Because all of the other testimony was about the teenagers. It was about how they were sassing their grandmother, about how they were doing drugs. None of that relates to the 3-year-old and why it was necessary to strike her 12 times the belt.
Without the KA language or the 2C38 language, without that as a simple assault, if the jury believed that the grandmother struck the child once, that would have been a simple assault, once without that defense. Do you agree?
I think what Judge, what was...
Do you agree with that?
That's not...
Do you agree?
I don't know that that's... When you're looking at a judge that has to decide whether the facts are clearly indicated, Your Honor...
Can you answer my question?
I can't answer your question the way you want me to.
She's the babysitter, okay, and not the custodian, strikes the child once, and the kid says, ouch. Is that an assault?
No, but I think the way you framed that question, Your Honor, was that here, what if this jury didn't believe, despite hearing it, didn't believe that it happened 12 times, only believed that it's one? But when we're looking at the clearly indicated standard, the judge has to find that the facts as presented to him clearly indicate all elements of the offense. And so I don't know that Judge English was required, he's not required to meticulously sift through the records. That's this court's precedent as recently as Walker. So why would the judge have to speculate with regard to whether the jury, despite hearing it happen 12 times, is going to find that it only happened once in order to give it a defense that's not been requested? The judge has to apply the clearly indicated standard to all elements of the offense, as this court said in Walker, and to the facts that were presented before him. I don't know that we're expecting trial courts to think about all permutations. I don't think our law requires it.
I think we have your position on this particular issue. May I bring you back to the question of simple assault in general?
Mm-hmm.
The simple assault was treated as a lesser included at the trial court level. Was that correct?
Is it
a lesser included?
I would agree that it's a lesser related. And I think what's important here, I don't think it's accurate when defense counsel said that it was like agreed to below. It was requested. The way I read the record in this is that it was specifically requested as a lesser included by defense counsel. Or lesser related.
Anything you'd like to add?
Thank you so much, Your Honor. Thank you to the court for your time.
Your Honor, can I have a couple minutes for a rebuttal? Thank you. I'd like to just quickly address Justice Patterson's concern about notice. And simple assault here didn't come up until the very end of the case. So even if notice was required, it couldn't have happened in this case. But as soon as simple assault came up, the defense counsel here requested that reasonable corporal punishment as a defense be given. And I'd like to reiterate again that substantively, when we look at the language of KA, we're saying the general proposition is that a parent may inflict moderate correction such as is reasonable under the circumstances of the case. And this is a totality of the circumstances analysis, as we've seen in the family law context, that captures those four elements that are articulated in the parental, or in the 2C38 defense. And at its core here, the question is really just whether defense counsel's request was sufficient such that the standard is rational basis or clearly indicated. And ALA's position is certainly that this was requested enough that the standard of review here is a rational basis standard. But even under a clearly indicated standard, there was enough evidence here that the court had to instruct the jury on that essential legal principle that reasonable corporal punishment is not a simple assault. And because that charge here was not given, we're looking at a harmless error standard. And was this error harmless? And the answer to that question is no, because it could have impacted jury deliberations. And had the jury been properly instructed, it could have acquitted ALA of simple assault.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel.